sunshine, little Uber, liver, liver, leaf.
Good evening and welcome to As the Worm Turns. You're tuned into KVNF's live call-in gardening show. I'm your host, Jill Spears, and of course, our favorite gardener, Lance Swaggart, here this evening. Good evening, Lance.
Good evening out there.
Great to have you here. And special guest, Don LaRoe from Zephro's Farm and Garden here in Paonia.
Hey.
Nice to have you here again, Don.
Yeah, good to be back.
Great. Last year you were here and we were talking about your seed-to-seed program that you guys worked on together. And that was that nine-month program that was wildly successful, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah. It was great. Yeah. Full room.
Full room. People from the Front Range all over the place.
Yeah, people from quite far away. So that was cool.
Yeah. Okay. So this show, you're here to talk about, well, we're coming on seed saving, but we're going to talk about a little bit about GMOs, and we're going to keep an agricultural focus on that. And thank you for being here, Don.
Yeah.
I'm going to give the phone numbers, 970-527-4868, 1-866-KVNF now. You can email us, worm@kvnf.org. So GMO, genetically modified organisms, what exactly is that?
Genetically, not being an expert, none of us are, but I think it's a great topic to think about and to try to bring some understanding to. Genetically modified organisms or genetically engineered organisms, I think they changed it to modified because that sounds less insidious.
Yes, it does a little softer.
So, but basically, there are a couple different ways they do it, but they take the genetic sequence from one species and insert it into another species.
Wow.
And the idea is that it imparts some desirable trait that increased nutrition, increased productivity, resistance to chemicals. There's a lot of different reasons that they do it, and we'll talk about some of them and the consequences of those.
A lot of different goals that they're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
One being, and we talk about food production all the time, yields and that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it seems like at first it comes out more, and then as you go along, it gets less. It seems like. And, so food production is not really the issue here.
Yeah, there definitely have been a lot of farmers who've turned away from it from a lack of yield standpoint.
So they get going in it, they're all gung-ho, and then maybe a few years get a nice crop.
Yeah. And I think it's important for people to understand what there's been a lot of things that are genetically modified out there. They've done it to dozens of different things. But currently, commercially, what the main crops that are genetically engineered, corn is probably the one that most people know about, soybeans. And obviously that's a huge portion of the production of the agricultural.
Isn't it the corn and soy? Isn't it reaching like 80% and 90% of the corn and soy is GMO?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Then canola and corn and soy, are for the vast majority for things like high fructose corn syrup, but mostly for animal feed. So the canola, though, is for oil, and canola is almost impossible to find non-genetically engineered canola. Cotton, sugar beets. There are some genetically engineered zucchinis, papaya, and within the last decade, alfalfa was another one that was released. And it's definitely here on the Western Slope. I know that there's some fields up in Grand Junction where they've been working with the genetically engineered alfalfa.
Yeah, I was just reading about bent grass. It's a grass used in the fairways of golf courses, and they've genetically modified it for Roundup Ready.
And they're worried
that the seeds, when that flowers, that goes into the wild grasses.
So when you say genetically modified for Roundup Ready, what exactly does that mean?
Well, it's resistant so that you can spray the herbicide Roundup or what's the...
Glyphosate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it will kill the broadleaves, and the grass will still grow,
right.
Or the corn will still grow, or the soy.
is ready to take it on.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I think to me that is probably one of the biggest things in terms of farmers and agriculture is the very predictable outcome from spraying thousands of acres with a chemical like that is that inevitably some of the plants are going to survive. And then those are going to be the plants that produce seedlings, and then they're going to all be able to survive that chemical, and that's what's happened. And so they're calling them super weeds. Mm-hmm. And so instead of sort of the claims of the Monsanto and the other companies, the other life science companies that do this genetic mm-hmm. engineering, you know, sort of saying, oh, we're going to have less chemicals. Well, now with the super weeds, the Roundup doesn't work. And right. so they've now released in the last few years, the last 4 or 5 years, they've actually upped the ante and now instead of Roundup ready, they have 2,4-D ready. And, you know, some mm-hmm. of our wow. older listeners will remember 2,4-D and killing the ospreys and working its way up the food chain. And dicamba, which I don't know a lot about, but I do know it's definitely more toxic than a Roundup. And so now you've got crops that are resistant to these chemicals.
Right.
And, you know, it just begs the question, well, then obviously aren't we going to now create another whole nother set of super weeds that are also resistant mm-hmm. to these chemicals?
It's like the antibiotic problem.
Yeah.
With strains of bacteria becoming resistant to all of the antibiotics
yeah.
overuse. Same thing.
Yep. Well, and they've seen the same thing with like goats and sheep and the chemicals they use to kill the bugs in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
The bugs have become resistant to all the different chemicals because they use them so much. So yeah, it shouldn't have, you know, and they said, oh, this won't be a problem. Well, sure enough, you know, it's a major problem. And actually they did find in a field in Kansas, a 2,4-D resistant weed.
Oh, wow.
Already.
Wow.
Which makes sense because if you've already bred a plant to be resistant to one chemical, it's probably more, mm-hmm. it would seem logical that it would also then be yeah. resistant so, to other chemicals more quickly.
2,4-D has been around since the 60s.
Oh yeah, it's part of Agent Orange.
Agent Orange, yeah, yep. That's what I thought.
Yep. You know, just some other things to talk about that get confusing about genetic engineering is if you're buying something that's certified organic, it's been verified to not have GMOs in it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of different ways to do that. Obviously, a farm like mine that's certified organic, I don't really have any neighbors growing genetically engineered products. It's mm-hmm. a pretty easy one. If you had a farm in the middle of Iowa and you were growing sweet corn, maybe that would be you'd have a different problem. Mm-hmm. So there's some testing that they'll do. Obviously there are, the government does try to work in some sort of allowable limits to, for certain crops and corn being the main one. Cause, you know, it's wind pollinated.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But there's another label out there that people will see on things quite often. It's the non-GMO label. And, you know, just to be clear, that means it's been verified to not have genetically modified organisms in it, but it doesn't mean that it's not sprayed or that it's not organic.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think there's probably some consumer confusion around some of that stuff.
Non-GMO, organic, and that the fact that organic fields can be contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about people changing their gardens over to organic? I mean, there's so much organic food. It always blows me away how that whole movement has grown so fast and that there's enough land and people changing their farms over to organic.
Yeah, well, part of the organic movement at this point, especially larger farms, it's actually where the market's going.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, that's one of the common arguments is that there's not enough land on the planet to grow organic food for everybody.
Oh, yes, there is.
Okay.
Yeah. There's plenty out there. Yeah.
Well, and I think, you know, what they've been finding where they've done long-term studies looking at conventional fields, biodynamic fields, organic fields, you know, and these are 20-plus-year studies, mm-hmm. is that over time, the organic, the biodynamic fields will become much, much more productive over time. The initial first few years to get the system up, and you know, it's a whole system. It's a system that relies on biology. And I mean, the genetically engineered thing is sort of the pinnacle of the sort of the green revolution, where basically biology is a meaningless entity. That you just stick one little bit of it in the ground, and then you use physics and chemistry to produce the food and not rely on the biology. And so, you know, you're really killing off a tremendous amount of soil microorganisms out there on these, you know, hundreds of millions of acres of ground that are being, you know, sprayed by all these different chemicals.
Yeah, that's the other problem that I was reading, is that in these fields, GMO fields, and they're using the weed herbicides that they're using, that it's actually totally changing the soil structure and the life and actually making it inert.
Right, and that's what we talk about.
And we want to go the other way.
Right, yeah. Soil life. Soil.
Yeah, not, yeah. It's making it not soil. It's making it dirt.
Yeah. Dirt, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, 527-4868-1866, KVNF Now, and Sam here in Paonia with a question. Good evening, Sam.
Hi, yeah, I was curious if you guys are talking about GMOs in entirety, because it does sound like you're talking specifically about foreign gene insertion as one category of GMOs. There's a whole other category with genetic modification techniques where they're enhancing genes within the genome of a given species, including, you know, DNA that may be silent and may be more appropriate for a given climate change regime, for example. So I'm curious if you are specifically talking about the foreign gene insertion and problems with that, or if you're looking at the whole class of GMOs in your conversation.
Well, that's a very good question.
Yeah, not really. Only because I don't think any of us feel equipped to talk about all of that, the sort of the CRISPR technology that has come along and the sort of the gene insertion. And there's obviously a lot of health care concerns and discussions. I mean, and I think the reality is that the major patented genes or varieties of these food crops that we have are these insertion ones. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff in the pipeline because of how quickly it happens. In terms of what's being produced out there, in terms of the food that and the farming that's happening, it really is still relied on sort of what I guess now is seen as sort of an older technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that just might nuance the conversation a little bit, because yeah, there are lots of possibilities, and especially in food, historically food insecure regions.
I think
production potential with that kind of technology has been really powerful. So it's just important to remember that there's many, many kinds of GMOs out there and possibilities out there.
Well, and I think the one of the arguments I would make to that is that there's also a tremendous amount of ability for classical breeding techniques to also offer solutions to those problems as well. You know,
and when an area is affected by a famine, it's hard to wait the many, many, many generations to get that classical breeding technique to produce the results.
Well, you also get what you put your money into. So the land grant universities for the last two decades have had almost zero money, and really it's in the last three or four decades that all of the classical breeding has been, it basically doesn't exist. There's a program at Oregon State University, Michigan State University. There's a couple other, Clemson is actually just starting one up. It's where the money's coming from also. So to say that, yeah, it would take potentially more time, but there's also a tremendous amount of genetic techniques and genetic monitoring and markers that they use now in within classical breeding techniques that allows all that to happen much, much more quickly.
You know? And that may be where we're converging on the same thing of,
yep.
Sure. Yep. Of like, that combination of using high tech to turn those genes back on that are silent in the genome for whatever reason within a given species. There's just that's kind of a fascinating frontier, and hopefully can be something that more people can get behind.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the greatest, I totally appreciate the call the intent, and I think there's a lot left to be figured out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think when I was in college, they taught me that 92% of genes were called junk DNA, and I had to answer that question on a test. And now, you know, this isn't that. I'm old, but I'm not that old. And, you know, and now they know that, of course, none of that was actually junk DNA. But the question, you know, that I think a lot of people have, and the reason that, for example, in Europe, it's still really very small acreage of genetically engineered crops out there, mostly in Spain, mostly corn, and is due to the fact that there's a lot of potential not well understood consequences that they just don't understand over the long term, like this bent grass that Lance was talking about getting mm-hmm. out into the wild and then not being able to get it cleaned up. And I think they're actually having issues with it in their irrigation ditches in,
mm-hmm.
You know, so I think the Flavor Saver tomato is one of the first sort of genetically engineered things that people might remember. And it was basically, you know, some genes that got inserted to make it last longer. And, in the last 10 years, they've identified the gene, and then they use that gene in hybrid tomatoes mm-hmm. to get you a red tomato in the grocery store in December mm-hmm. or January. And now there's several heirloom breeders who have taken this understanding, have gotten this gene into the two parents of heirloom varieties
wow.
and bred it in. And there's some tomatoes, and we've grown them, and they're pretty amazing because it's like these little cherry tomatoes, and you can leave mm-hmm. them out on your kitchen counter, and they last for a month. It's amazing.
Wow.
You know, and they have this sort of cool heirloom look and cool mm-hmm. heirloom flavor, or delicious heirloom flavor.
All right, Sam. Yeah, we do appreciate the call because it is a big topic and it deserves conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot to it, a lot of...
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, we were talking before the show that just how big the conversation is and that there are a lot of great technologies out there that we...
Yeah, a half an hour is not enough time
right.
to
no.
even scratch the surface.
Yeah, and some amazing stuff going on.
We're also
on.
trying to be honest to what we know and
right.
and
yeah.
keep it in that realm.
Yeah,
And not to damn all genetic engineering out there, because that's not my intention.
Right. So let me give you the phone numbers, 527-4868-866 KVNF now. Let's talk a little bit about seeds, because we've been on seeds for mm-hmm. January. And what about patented seeds?
Patented seeds?
Mm-hmm.
Well, all the GMO seeds are patented.
Mm-hmm.
And the process that they do that is also patented.
Okay, so that's where you have to watch where you get your seeds.
Where you get it and stuff. And the thing is, if you're going to be growing the companies that own these patents, you got to buy the seed from them. And what kind of contract do you have to? I think you can't save the seed. You got to sell it all back to them.
Yeah, you have to get a technology use agreement when growing their crops, and you can't save the seed. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. Seeds were not allowed to be patented. There was a court case in 1980 where they allowed a patent of a genetically engineered microbe. And then the Reagan administration allowed a patent on a sexually reproducing plant for the first time. And then it eventually wound up in the Supreme Court in a pretty well-known case in this regard between JEM Ag Supply and Pioneer Hybrid, which is a big company that I'm sure has been bought by Dow or somebody now. Mm-hmm. And the court held, quote, and the court held in an opinion written by former Monsanto attorney Justice Clarence Thomas that even though Congress had never approved the patenting of seeds, it remained legal for the patent office to patent seeds because Congress had not passed a law specifically against it. It's pretty classic.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's kind of, you know, the patenting of life. And I think, you know, for those of us who work with seeds and want to breed seeds that can be shared,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is all part of sort of the idea of owning life and the idea of owning a specific gene or a yeah. specific gene sequence, when it's really that this is, you know, this is sort of the another big stumbling block for me with, you know, looking at this technology and yeah. trying to get behind it. It's not that
the ownership that piece of
it isn't potential, but it's mm-hmm. it's sort of that you know, whose is this really?
Mm-hmm.
Is this the common? Is this for the common good?
Yeah.
Or is this for corporate profits?
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of discussion there.
Yeah, so well, anything
patented, another slippery slope.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've mentioned in the past any of the seed catalyst says PVP.
Right, PVP.
Plant varietal protection, that's patented.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can grow it, but technically you can't grow it out for seed.
Out for seed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to remind everybody that tomorrow in Hotchkiss at the library from 4 to 6 p.m. is a seed sorting party with your neighbors and your community.
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Food and a lot of fun.
What time is that?
4 to 6.
4 to 6.
Yep.
Cool.
At the Hotchkiss Library. So, all right. 527-486-8186. KVNF now.
So the other sort of one of the big ones that's out there and grown on a large scale that I think is really important and particularly important to organic farmers are the ones that have been genetically engineered for BT, which stands for Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a microbe that when consumed by caterpillars,
mm-hmm.
it then consumes them. So, and it's something that we use on our farm all the time.
Yeah.
As an organic farmer, it's one of a very few insecticides that we can use because it's a natural product. It's just an organism. And so we spray it on various crops that get affected by coddling moth, by the not the coddling moth, but the cabbage lopers and
yeah.
What it's used for, we use it for a lot of different things, the hornworms.
Hornworms, the corn earworm.
But what they're, you know, and we're lucky to live in a place where the insects we're dealing with aren't eating this all the time, but the insects in the Midwest where they are coming are also now resistant to BT. So it becomes you know, you sort of take out a pretty limited amount of options for organic farmers.
Yeah.
You take away a pretty big one.
Yeah. Again, those organisms will get resistant to it.
Right.
And it's being used a lot. And yeah, we don't have that much here, but it will eventually happen.
Yeah. Hey, it's Anthony from Grand Junction on the line. Hi, Anthony. How are you today?
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey. Good to hear from you.
It's good. This show is pretty deep. So anyway, I'm going to just fly. Excuse me. Let me just really quick. I'm going to just fly right by all this eugenics, okay? And ask a question about a euonymus, which is a GMO product. I got it at Home Depot for my mom. It survived for like two or three years. Now it's doing really well. But over on the Front Range, they shed their leaves, Lance, in the fall.
Uh-huh.
They don't
yeah.
over here. So what's the deal?
Euonymus, and what do you know what variety it is?
No,
it's a landscape plant.
None.
Yeah, it's a. Let's say.
It's generally speaking, we planted it here when I was landscaping. It was one of the few broadleaf evergreens.
Uh huh.
And I think
that's nice.
Yeah, and that's you know, I don't know what it was doing on the front range. You said it was losing its leaves on the front range?
Yeah, they lose in the fall. They drop their leaves.
Uh huh.
Yeah. But here, well, it's in a very warm south sort of location against a wall, but it doesn't lose them. They'll wilt down like crazy when it's really cold and come right back.
Yep.
I give it a little water.
You know,
Yeah.
And there's definitely many varieties. And I suspect you have Euonymus Manhattan.
That might have been.
And it's a broadleaf.
Yeah,
it just keeps its leaves. I've never seen one that was deciduous unless the deer ate the leaves.
Really?
Yeah, the deer. They've all always kept their leaves here in the area.
Well, they used to on the front range.
I have a client that I work for that plant is 6 or 7 feet tall, and it's nothing but leaves.
Wow.
Right now, green leaves.
Right.
Yeah.
That's great. It's an awesome plant, actually, over here because it stays green all year.
Mm-hmm.
That's really nice.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
All right, thanks.
Hey, good to hear from you. Thanks, Anthony.
Thanks.
All right. So Don LaRoe from Zephro's Farm and Garden here this evening, keeping a talk about GMOs and agricultural focus. And there's a lot of things we can do just organically to accomplish some of the same things that GMO farming tries to do, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it gets back to what we were talking about with the last call it with Sam was, you know, is that it's all about research dollars. And right now, I mean, the organic industry doesn't even get their fair share. If organic food is 3 to 4% of what gets consumed out there, and it should easily get 3 to 4% of the research dollars, but that's not true. It gets more like 1.5% of the research dollars. And a lot of times at the land grant universities like CSU, you know, there's very few land grant universities that have organic land, that have organic breeding programs. And they basically get their money from corporations, and these corporations are doing research in genetic engineering and chemicals and all of that sort of stuff. So I think, you know, there definitely are those answers. It's also about getting, you know, the money going to the right places so that university professors can actually afford to do the research that we need.
Yeah, and we're lucky enough to have the research station here on Rogers Mesa,
which is
certified organic, the whole place.
Right?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's a rare gem out there because there's not very many universities that have organic land at all. So,
are they still having their Thursday brown bag lunch up there, Lance?
I do not know.
They do. I'm not sure it's every week,
but
you can definitely call over there and get on an email list, and they get a lot of different people coming, coming talking.
Yeah,
I've been to a couple.
What a great place to explore! If you're new to the area, you know, check it out. Okay, and some things coming up, Lance. You've got the Seed School in a Day that's coming up with Laura
Parker.
And that's March 8th in Hotchkiss.
At the Memorial Hall at Hotchkiss.
Okay, so we've got time to remind people about that.
Yeah, and I think that's the Learning Council, so they might have it on their website.
Okay. And, hey, it's Sarah in Hotchkiss on the line. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good.
Good. Awesome. Good to hear from you.
Yeah. Hey, I was just wondering, you know, as you're talking about GMOs and organics and these, you know, land-grant universities, just kind of wondering if you had any tips for consumers on ways to, you know, maybe avoid GMOs or support organics or different maybe crops or varieties to avoid or be wary of, or just any tips of what a, you know, everyday consumer can do to help.
All right.
Yeah, there's a few out there. I mean, just if it's said USDA certified organic, it's non-GMO. And as Don mentioned earlier, the non-GMO project doesn't mean it's organic, but it doesn't have GMOs. And then there's, what, four more main things?
I mean, yeah, as long as you're, you know, avoiding corn, soy, canola, I mean, alfalfa, but that's really not, you know, I mean, alfalfa sprouts, but I don't think that that's an issue if you are. A lot of sprouts are organic. Sugar beets, so that's a hard one because it's going to be hard pressed to know that something you're eating has sugar from sugar beets in it versus sugar from another source.
High fructose corn syrup.
Yeah. That's one to avoid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you, Sarah. Great question. All right. Next week, it's going to be Pat Frazier from Peace and Plenty Farms and Alicia Michelson. We're going to be talking about herbs. There's going to be an herb school going on. Mm-hmm. So you guys are great bringing all of this knowledge and stuff to the Valley and to our listeners. So thank you very much.
Should be an awesome herb school. It's sort of like the seed school was once a week for nine
months. Once a month.
Once a month. Sorry, once a month for 9 months on different farms and learning from a lot of different people. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that's up at vogaco.org or the Learning Council.
Okay, website. Super. Tune in next week for that show. And Don, hope to have you back as the season goes on. Thanks so much for being here and tackling this subject. And Lance, you're taking a little break. We'll see you in a few weeks.
Couple weeks.
All right.
Yeah, I'll be back.
Okay, it's Joyous Rainbow coming up with One Woman's Perspective next. Thanks for listening to As the Worm Turns.
Right. Have a good evening.
Good night.
Earth-friendly.